Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast.
Oh yeah.
Alternative news, analysis and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Grab your hands.
Good morning, and you're listening to 3CR Breakfast on Tuesday, the 20th of January, 2026. My name is Fung, and it's just me in the studio with you this morning. Today is our first live show for the year, so welcome back, and we hope you are having a safe and happy summer break. And if you've been tuning into Tuesday Breakfast the last few weeks, you would know that we've been on a summer break and have produced some special summer shows, giving you the highlights and our favorite interviews from 2025. So those will be online soon. So if you'd like to check that out, you can go to 3cr.org.au/Tuesday-breakfast. But yeah, we hope that wherever you are having a nice, relaxing morning. I know that when I left the house this morning, the sky was really beautiful. So yeah, hope you're taking it easy this morning. Just to let you know what's coming up on today's show, we start the program this morning by playing a segment from Tuesday Hometown Light, presented by guest hosts during Jan Bartlett's regular summer break. So today we'll be hearing from Kath Strong, who spoke to Marion about boycotting the 2026 Eurovision Song Contest, and especially about how the state of Israel uses international cultural events such like Eurovision to project soft power and clean its image by pink washing. So that's coming up first, and it will also feature a statement from local queer artist Montaigne. At 7:30, we'll be joined again by Lucinda Thorpe, who is privacy campaigner at Digital Rights Watch. Regular listeners of Tuesday Breakfast would know that in 2025, she was on the program a lot to give us the latest news regarding technology and how it's impacting our privacy online. And so for today's show, Lucinda will be on the program to discuss the news surrounding Grok, which is the AI tool developed by Elon Musk's xAI, which has been used as a mechanism for image-based abuse targeting women and children. So we'll be looking at that issue and the response needed to tackle this kind of technology. At 7:45, we'll be playing a speech from local elder Auntie Janet Galpin, who spoke at last year's Tunaminawait and Mulboyhina commemoration. That is actually taking place today at midday, and there'll be a live cross to that event here on 3CR. So to prepare everyone for that, we'll be playing a speech, A Welcome to Country by Auntie Janet Galpin, who spoke at the commemoration last year. At 8 o'clock this morning, we'll be joined by Rosemary Story, who is a passionate defender of the forests of the Central Highlands and is also a member of Kinglake Friends of the Forest. Rosemary will be talking to us about a recent news reported by Kinglake Friends of the Forest as well as other independent media regarding the Victorian government's target for containing bushfires set at 80% and what that means for funding to firefighters and organisations who are trying to tackle bushfires in the state. And finally, at 8:15, we'll be listening to an interview from Hung from 3CR's Women on the Line, who spoke to Wen Mao Xin, who is a photographer and visual artist based in Nam. And they'll be speaking about her upcoming art show called I Am a Feminist Lesbian Woman of Colour, which opens tomorrow, the 21st of January. So that will be our show for this morning. So hope you can stick around. But first, we'll be giving you our news headlines for today.
Some folks know about it, some don't. Some will learn to shout it, some won't. But sooner or later, baby, here's a ditty. Say you're gonna have to get right down to the real nitty gritty. Let's get right down to the real nitty gritty now. One, two.
You're listening to 3CR Breakfast on 855 AM, 3CR Digital, and online at 3cr.org.au. And these are the news headlines for Tuesday, the 20th of January, 2026. On January the 7th, 2026, a woman in Minneapolis was killed by a federal immigration officer. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, officers confronted the 37-year-old U.S. citizen Renee Nicole Good on a residential street in South Minneapolis as Good attempted to drive away from the officers, one-shot her three times at close range. The federal official claims that Good had weaponized her vehicle and attempted to kill officers. However, these statements have been clearly contradicted by video evidence. Videos of the incident show that at the time when the shots were fired, the officer was positioned on the far left side of the vehicle outside its direct path, and the vehicle was moving away from him and the other officers. The combined video analysis shows that the officer could not have reasonably feared death or serious physical injury. The death of Renee Good has sparked outrage in Minneapolis, with multiple anti-ICE protests breaking out across the city. Also in the news, protesters in Sydney have vowed to return for Invasion Day rallies on the 26th of January after being dispersed at a rally against Indigenous deaths in custody on Sunday. In the lead-up to the event, demonstrators said they were planning to march in defiance of the New South Wales government's controversial new protest laws. However, moments before protesters were set to depart Hyde Park, police told event organiser Paul Silver to request that the crowd disperse in a peaceful and orderly manner. Silver then instructed the crowd that he thought it would be the safest option if we disperse. Following the Bondi terror attack, New South Wales passed new legislation giving the state's police commissioner the power to restrict protests for up to 3 months after a designated terrorist incident. A declaration was made immediately after the laws were passed, and it has already been extended until the 20th of January. Organisers had requested an exemption for Sunday's event, which marked 10 years since the death of David Dungar Jr., but it was denied. Dungar Jr., a Dungari man, died in Sydney's Long Bay prison in 2015 after guards rushed into his cell to stop him eating biscuits. In the 2024-2025 financial year, Australia recorded 33 Indigenous deaths in custody, the highest number since monitoring began in 1979. In other news, a federal appeals court on Thursday granted the Trump administration a victory in its efforts to deport Palestinian activist Mahmoud Khalil, which potentially enables his rearrest. Khalil was a graduate student at Columbia University when he was arrested in March and detained for months, missing the birth of his first child. A statement made by Khalil says, "The door may have been opened for potential re-detainment down the line, but it has not closed our commitment to Palestine and to justice and accountability." I will continue to fight through every legal avenue and with every ounce of determination until my rights and the rights of others like me are fully protected. He was the first non-citizen student targeted and arrested by the Trump administration for pro-Palestine speech, detained for months, first in New Jersey, then in Louisiana, before a federal district judge in New Jersey granted a habeas petition in his case, saying his constitutional rights had likely been violated. Now, in a split 2-1 decision, the Third Circuit Court of Appeals has overturned that ruling on jurisdictional grounds, saying Khalil should have first appealed his removal in immigration court. On Thursday, New York City Mayor Zoran Mamdani voiced concern about the ruling. Last year's arrest of Mahmoud Khalil was more than just a chilling act of political repression. It was an attack on all of our constitutional rights, Mamdani wrote on X. Now, as the crackdown on pro-Palestinian free speech continues, Mahmoud is being threatened with rearrest. Mahmoud is free and must remain free. Finally, in the headlines, a legal challenge to Victoria Police's decision to declare the entire Melbourne CBD a designated area, which grants officers expanded warrantless stop and search powers, will be proceeding, despite police revoking the declarations 4 months ahead of schedule. Victoria Police made the six-month declaration in late November, a move which drew strong criticism from legal and Indigenous organisations, many of which raised concerns about alleged racial profiling by the force. Last week, police revoked the declaration without providing a reason, just days before the federal court was due to begin hearing a challenge brought by Gunditjmara, Yorta Yorta, Bindal and Meriam community organiser Tarneen Onus Brown and activist Benny Zabel. Onus Brown, who regularly organises the annual NAM Invasion Day protest on January 26, said they welcomed the early end to the declaration. Nonetheless, they said the legal challenge needed to continue so people can protest peacefully at Invasion Day rallies without being subjected to warrantless searches, noting the police powers would not only affect First Peoples, but anyone entering the CBD. These have been the news headlines for Tuesday, 20th of January, 2026. You're listening to 3CR Breakfast on 855 AM.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
Monday, the 26th of January, marks Invasion Day, and 3CR's First Nations broadcast team will be bringing an annual Invasion Day broadcast to the airwaves from 10 a.m.
In 1788, down Sydney Cove, first boat people land, and they say, "Sorry boys, I gained your loss. We're gonna steal your land."
Our team will be broadcasting speeches from the NAM rally and conversations with people attending the march, as well as connecting with Aboriginal activists from across the continent at the forefront of campaigns for land rights, restoration, restitution, and real treaties, and learning about the way it may be done. And of course, we'll be playing deadly music from our incredible black artists, past and present. So keep it tuned to 3CR, 8:55 a.m, 3CR Digital, 3cr.org.au streaming live on Monday, the 26th of January from 10 a.m.
Lest we forget, join us to commemorate the 184th anniversary of the execution of the two Indigenous freedom fighters, Tunaminaway and Morbohina, the first men hung in Victoria for resisting white colonisation.
This is a story of colonisation. It's a story that's been told before.
It's the Tuesday, the 25th of January at midday, at the Tunaminaway and Morbohina Monument at the corner of Victoria and Franklin Street in Melbourne. the ceremony will be broadcast live on Community Radio 3CR. At 1 p.m. after the broadcast, we'll be walking down the Queen Victoria Market to what we believe is their burial site, where the ceremony will continue for another hour. Please bring flowers to the event.
Hi, my name is Miss Kinnina. I'm a proud Yorta Yorta, Dja Dja Rong, Kalkadoon and Yirrindali Aboriginal Sovereign Woman. And you're listening to 3CR, guys. Check in with your friends. Make sure you guys are going good. And also stick up for what's right, yeah? Free Palestine.
You're listening to 3CR Breakfast on 855 AM, 3CR Digital and 3cr.org.au. This first segment is from Tuesday Hometime Light, which is presented by guest hosts during Jan Bartlett's regular summer break. And late in December, Kath Strong spent part of her annual leave time speaking with Marion for Tuesday Hometime. A researcher of popular music, Kath discussed calls to boycott the 2026 Eurovision Song Contest. In this excerpt, we hear how the State of Israel uses this international cultural event to project soft power and clean its image by pink washing. You'll also hear part of a statement from queer artist Montaigne.
Kath Strong, welcome to Community Radio 3CR.
I am a popular music studies scholar, and one of the things that I've looked at over the years is at the Eurovision Song Contest, which I am also very interested in as a fan of the contest. I watch it every year, although I won't be next year. I think it's a lot of fun. So it's sort of a personal and a professional interest. The reason people are calling for a boycott of Eurovision next year is because a lot of countries are saying it is not really conscionable at this point that Israel continues to be part of the competition. The UN have said that what is going on in Gaza could be described as a genocide. We have seen over the last few months, since there has supposedly been a ceasefire, I think in the region of around 300 people have been killed since that ceasefire came into effect. And a number of those have been children who've been targeted by snipers, things like that. Countries are saying, look, you can't have a country that is behaving in this way given access to cultural events that are good for their image, essentially, which Eurovision in particular has been a place where Israel has had a platform that they have really taken advantage of in terms of portraying themselves as being fun, as being a tolerant. That, you know, they often will send competitors who are from the LGBTQI plus community to make themselves look progressive, to look as though they are part of the civilized world, and then also behaving like this towards people who are essentially in a place that's under their control. And people are saying, look, enough is enough. We need to be putting every single type of pressure that we can on Israel to stop doing these things. And cultural boycotts are one of the things that we can use to get this to happen.
Thank you. So for many activists, there's a double standard that's becoming impossible to ignore, where Eurovision banned Russia in 2022 over its Ukraine invasion, yet we continue to offer a global stage to Israel, despite its UN-recognised genocide, as you outlined. Ireland, Slovenia, Spain and the Netherlands are either withdrawing from the 2026 Eurovision or considering doing that.
I think Iceland as well. And what we've seen just in the last couple of weeks too is that there are quite a number of artists, like individual artists, who are starting to come out and make statements too. So I think Portugal has had quite a few of the artists who could have been going have refused to take part in their internal competition. There was one artist in particular who won the competition a few years ago who was asked back to perform in 2026, and they've refused to do that. We've also seen the winner from last year, from 2024, Nemo, sent their trophy back because they've said that they just don't want to be associated with the competition if the competition is going to continue to have Israel taking part. So, and I think it is going to be really interesting to see over the next few months. What normally happens is that countries will hold competition internally where they will have 10, 15 performers, and people within their country will vote for who they want to go to Eurovision. I think there will be a lot of things playing out there where there are going to be people who will refuse to take part in those competitions or who will use those competitions to make statements about the political aspects of what's going on. And I think it will be very interesting to see who actually ends up going. And this is something I think SBS is going to have to grapple with. Who is Australia going to send? Because whoever they send is going to be essentially placed into the middle of this very, very difficult political situation. And there is no way that it won't have some sort of consequence for their career as an artist. Often people see being put forward as Australia's Eurovision contestant as a really good opportunity because it will put you in front of an audience that you wouldn't have had access to otherwise, in front of millions of people right around the world. Like, people's careers could absolutely explode after being at Eurovision. But this year, you are being put into a situation where this could tank your career, possibly. I don't know how it will play out, but you're going to be being asked to have a stance on Israel. You're not going to be able to be just like quietly apolitical, because even being silent on this issue at the moment will be taken as a statement of sorts. So I think there's an interesting ethical quandary that SBS has now sort of put themselves in that it is very possible that the artist they send is going to be damaged by representing Australia in 2026. So, you know, the question is it ethical to send somebody under those circumstances? Unless they find somebody who is like a full Israel supporter, who was already known to be a supporter of Israel. That's the only way I think that somebody's artist brand isn't going to be damaged by this.
I love that there's an upside to that, which would be having the internal competition and the internal discussion. I'm going to quote from Montaigne. So this is the artist Montaigne, who says the fight for queer liberation can't be separated from the struggle for Palestinian freedom. As queer people, we know what it means to fight for dignity, visibility, and safety. Those values mean nothing if we abandon Palestinians living under military terror or First Nations people here who still face systemic injustice. Our rights are tied together. I'm calling on SBS and all Australian artists to boycott Eurovision for as long as Israel is allowed to participate. So strong words there from Montaigne.
Sometimes because something is a commercial product, we can get a little bit too, you know, this is just something that's being bought and sold and people are making their careers out of it, and it can't cut through on a political level. But I think just the way that what we've seen with the Eurovision discussion is that this song contest that people still think of as being like a little bit silly and a little bit camp and a little bit, you know, silly spectacle, I think a lot of the time, like people who aren't big fans laugh at it and think that it's just a bit of a strange cultural phenomenon that they don't really understand. It has gotten the whole world talking about what is happening in Gaza. And it's not like the world wasn't talking about what's happening in Gaza, but it's brought a different element to the discussion. And it has also shown, I think, a lot of people that there are a whole bunch of different ways in which you can approach this question and put pressure on a country, not only the country itself, Israel, that's doing the harm, but that you can also use culture to pressure your own governments. So we are sending, by going outside SBS, even though, you know, SBS is a separate entity from, you know, the government, it's not controlled by the government, but, you know, every bit of coverage that we can get for, we are trying to get Australia to not go to Eurovision, is going to be feeding up into the national discourse around this topic. This whole discussion is going to be different now after what's happened in Bondi and the way that the response to that has been to try and say that people who have been protesting and talking on behalf of the Palestinians who are being killed in Gaza, that those people are the problem. And so I think we have a much bigger fight on our hands when it comes to getting our voices to be heard on this topic in the way that they should be. I think it will be very interesting to see how the Eurovision aspect of this plays out. I think there is definitely a possibility that it will just be seen as being frivolous, you know, in the context of a massacre that's taken place on our own soil. The question about whether or not a song contest should be happening will be sidelined. But as we go into the new year and as we get closer to the actual competition itself, there will be space for those discussions to open up again and to take more of a prominent position. And I think, again, this question of who the artist is and what happens to them, because they definitely will be pressured by activists, probably on both sides, to be acting in a particular way, and how they cope with that and respond to that, and then how pressure is still put on SBS and associated entities to not take part in this, including, I imagine, the people who are the presenters who go over there every year to talk about it. Who are they going to be next year, and how will they be pressured to go or not go or say certain things or not say certain things? That there are going to be so many people caught up in this, and how that all plays out is going to be very interesting to see, I think. So Eurovision is, as Montaigne has pointed out, a place where LGBTQI plus people have always had a place on that stage. And one of the things that Israel has done over the years is use it as one of the tools in their pinkwashing toolkit. So that means that they have used the idea that they are a LGBTQIA plus friendly nation as one of the ways to present themselves as upstanding global citizens, basically. And they've done that in a way that is like, oh, look, we love queer people, but all of these nations around us, these Middle Eastern Muslim nations, they don't like queer people, but we do. So we are like sort of morally upstanding, and we are better than them, essentially, right? But there's a lot of scholarship on this. This isn't just me sort of riffing on that idea. A lot of people have spoken about how pinkwashing is something that Israel has like explicitly used and deliberately used as a way of contrasting themselves with the Muslim countries that they are close to. The way that this has sort of continued to be used around something like Gaza is that you will sort of see people say, oh, well, you know, Israel is doing this thing against these people who are anti-queer, which is not even the case. I think if you speak to Palestinians, that they would say that there is something much more complicated than that going on. And also, you know, you can't liberate queer people who are dead. Eurovision is a queer iconic event, right? It's embraced by the queer community. It's a time when the queer community comes together, watches it, celebrates it. And the way I think that the queer community around the world has come out to oppose the genocide, because as Montaigne has said in their statement, they understand what it is to be oppressed and to have to fight for their own existence. So they identify more with the people in Gaza than with the Israeli government at this point in time. So I think that it will also be very interesting to see what the audience for Eurovision next year ends up looking like, whether there is a significant decline in the audience, because I think that certainly there will be a lot of the key constituents who usually will tune into that event will be asking serious questions about whether or not they should be doing that. Interesting questions to be seen in terms of the artists that go, the media that attends and how they respond, and also how audiences will respond. There is a lot of online discourse at the moment that is just basically saying, can't believe Eurovision has destroyed itself like this. And there's definitely a chance that this event will look very, very different from 2026 and into the future, unless they have a serious conversation with themselves about what they're doing.
Thank you so much. If listeners want to have a look at your article, it's easily searched in the conversation.
September or October. A lot has happened since then.
Yeah, so thank you so much for for giving the updated context for that and for speaking with us today on 3CR. Thanks, Kath.
Thanks very much, Marion.
That was Kath Strong speaking to Marion for Tuesday Home Time about boycotting the 2026 Eurovision Song Contest. We'll be back with our next interview in just a moment.
Keffiyehs are Palestinian scarves, and they're a symbol of support for justice for the Palestinian people. From the traditional black and white keffiyeh to an array of modern designs, explore the range and order online or drop by 3CR during business hours. Wear your support for the rights of Palestinians. Go to kufiyas.org.au. That's kufiyas.org.au. A 3CR supporter.
You're listening to 3CR Breakfast. We just heard an interview between Kath Strong and Marion, and we are now joined on the line by Lucinda Thorpe, who is privacy campaigner at Digital Rights Watch. In 2025, she was a regular on our show to give us the latest news regarding technology and how it is impacting our privacy online. And this morning, Lucinda joins us on the show to talk about Grok, which is the AI tool developed by Elon Musk's xAI, which is being used as a mechanism for image-based abuse aimed at degrading and humiliating women and children. And we'll be also talking about the responses needed to tackle this kind of technology. Welcome back to 3CR, Lucinda.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you so much for joining us and for being available to talk about this really important issue. To start off with, for people who are perhaps unfamiliar with this platform and what's been happening since the beginning of the year, can you explain to us what Grok is and its relationship to X and Elon Musk?
Absolutely. So Grok is an AI which is owned by Elon Musk. It exists independently as an app, but it also exists within X. X is a social media platform. It used to be called Twitter. So it's owned by X, and it also is subject to a lot of misinformation. And that's because one of the key features of Grok is that it hoovers up all of the recent tweets or X posts which have been made, and that can include commentary on like current events. So it means that it talks about more current events than, say, ChatGPT does, because they're more hoovering up things like news articles, which have to go through some level, hopefully anyway, of fact verification. So Grok is very prolific in spouting misinformation, particularly in regards to Elon Musk, which is interesting.
And so the reason why you're on the show this morning is to talk about news regarding Grok. Since the beginning of the year, we've seen that it has been producing images of women and children in various situation scenarios as a responding to prompts from users on X. So I was wondering if you could talk a bit about this and how the creation of this content has actually come about.
Yeah, 100%. So The Guardian reported in their investigation that Grok was receiving 6,000 requests an hour for this type of content. So it is absolutely prolific out there. Now, I mentioned before that Grok kind of hoovers up all of the X posts. Now, this is important because X is a really popular channel for sex workers to attract clients and promote their businesses. So it becomes home to a lot of sexually explicit material, and often without the consent or in any regard to the privacy of the people posting these photos, they will get hoovered up and elements of them can then be reproduced in the images generated by the AI. That's really problematic, Also really problematic is that in the last 6 months of 2024 alone, the National Centre for Missing and Exploited Children identified over 300,000 instances of child abuse on the platform. All of those would have also been hoovered up into Grok for training. So when prompted to create images of children, the model draws on all of this training data, including that material. The complete lack of guardrails means that it can reproduce child sexual abuse material with relative accuracy, and that's what we're seeing it do when it's prompted to do so, which is really troublesome.
Yeah, that is really horrific. And yeah, I've read a few articles on this and read the reaction and response from people who have had their photos being used and manipulated in this way. In terms of the responsibility of X as a platform, are there any, you said there weren't any guardrails in place, but are there any sort of is there any sort of regulation when it comes to the responsibility of a platform to stop this kind of behavior or restrict it in any way?
You're asking a really important question there. So currently the answer is no. The responsibility lies with those affected to report it. For example, to the eSafety Commissioner, they can take down images of you, even if they are AI generated, which you don't consent to being up there and are sexually explicit. You can also report that child sexual abuse material to eSafety, and they can then report it and try and take it down. But historically, social media services have not been very compliant with these takedown requests. And this kind of model really places the burden back on women and children mostly to regulate an algorithm. It should be the algorithm which is regulated. We should be stopping this at the source of the problem. And X and Grok are so bad at self-regulation. Elon Musk is constantly chipping away at any sort of moderation that they have in the name of free speech. But as we can see, this is what it looks like when algorithms are just completely left to their own devices. Mm. And I will say, this AI is not the only one trained on this sort of material. But AIs such as Midjourney, which is a really popular image generation AI, has its flaws, but at least it has these guardrails, which mean it's not producing the worst kind of abhorrent material. Mm. So it is entirely possible and necessary for these guardrails to be put in place.
Yeah. And what can you tell us regarding the response from countries, governments from around the world? I read that Indonesia and Malaysia announced that they would be blocking it, but some users have reported they have still been able to access Grok using VPNs and other means. Can you talk a bit about Australia's response and, again, whether there are current laws or safeguards in place to protect people from this sort of technology?
So as long as these AI systems are unchecked, the safety and privacy of women and children will be jeopardised. So Albanese described Grok's generation of this content as abhorrent, but he hasn't introduced any measures to meaningfully protect those affected by this abusive technology. We need to see the algorithms that produce these abusive images be regulated rather than just the output of them be regulated. So Grok is riddled with misinformation, and its lack of guardrails for image generation make it a really dangerous tool. So banning it does make sense, but historically banning things just doesn't work. Like we said with the social media ban, all you need is a VPN to get around it.
And I guess this forms, you know, part of a broader discussion and around the trend of AI being used to commit gender-based violence. We spoke to Dr. Caitlin McGrain last year about women navigating online spaces and being subjected to horrific gender-based violence just, you know, merely through existing online as a public figure in various domains. So, yeah, I was wondering if you could just talk about this. Is it a trend that we're seeing? And how do we curb this? I mean, you were saying that, you know, we have to tackle the algorithms, which just sounds really complex and quite difficult.
Yeah, so the first thing I'd like to say is tackling these algorithms. When people hear about algorithms, you think of something very intangible and something that's really hard to regulate. But in reality, it's very possible. And countries around the world, like in the EU, are mandating this for the high-risk AIs under their new GDPR regulations. So it is entirely possible. And you're 100% right in saying that AI is being used to commit gender-based violence. 90 to 95% of all deepfakes created are non-consensual pornographic material. So the primary function of that technology is gender-based violence. Mm-hmm. But it goes beyond just image-based abuse as well. AI has also been used to dox women who call out misogyny online. AI can quickly filter through their posts and find personal information and analyze that metadata to craft personalized and threatening messages which expose their personal information. So up to 58% of women have experienced some form of tech-facilitated gender-based violence. So as AI is embedded into these different technologies, it's also going to be used as a tool to harm women as well. And unless these algorithms are regulated, this is a trend which will be here to stay.
Mm. And as you were saying before, Lucinda, like it shouldn't be up to women and children to report or regulate material that's been produced of them. It's just another form of victim blaming, which we see in other spaces. So yeah, this seems like it's a really horrific trend that we're seeing and a story that just continues to evolve, especially when we're talking about AI and social media platforms. So I'm sure we'll be having this discussion again. But for now, Lucinda, thank you so much for joining us on the show to give us, an introduction, a look into what's been happening there.
No worries. It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
We've been speaking to Lucinda Thorpe, who is privacy campaigner at Digital Rights Watch, and she was just on the program speaking to us about Grok and how it's been used as a mechanism for image-based abuse targeting women and children. Before we go to our next segment, we're going to play a song for you now. On the weekend, there was a gathering for Gaza event which was raising money for humanitarian aid in Palestine, and this took place in Naam in Port Melbourne. So all the artists that we're playing for you this morning were featured at the event. First up is Naam-based singer-songwriter Julia Jacqueline. This song comes from her 2016 album Don't Let the Kids Win, and it's called Pool Party.
Hit me high.
You're listening to 3CR Tuesday Breakfast, and that was the song Pool Party by Julia Jacklin. At midday today, 3CR will broadcast live from the Tunaminaway and Mulbohena Memorial on the corner of Victoria Street and Franklin Street, Melbourne, the site where these two Aboriginal freedom fighters were executed 184 years ago. Since 2006, the Tunaminaway and Mulbohena Commemoration Committee has held a public ceremony every year to pay respect to the tens of thousands of First Nations men, women and children who were slaughtered during the colonisation process, a process whose impacts continue to profoundly affect First Nations people today. In 2016, Melbourne City Council erected the Tunaminaway and Mulbohena Monument at the site where these two Indigenous freedom fighters were executed on January 20 in 1842, the first two people hung in Victoria for resisting British colonisation. This morning, we'll hear from local elder Auntie Janet Galpin, who spoke at the commemoration last year.
Womanchika. Womanchika is the Bunwarang language word for come with purpose. So Womanchika, Miram Bikbik, Bunwarang, Namdur, Barupton, Atawilam, come with purpose to our beautiful home, land of the 2 days. And we also pay our respect today to the Wurundjeri of the Woiwurrung, with whom we share many common boundaries throughout our lands, and our respect to any Wurundjeri with us today. I always feel privileged to be able to speak with you and to talk about our people. So today it's my purpose to deliver a welcome to country, and I have been asked many, many years ago by Professor Narweet, Professor Carolyn Biggs, to come and talk on her behalf. So we have the pleasure of welcoming you from whichever country that you're from, and to acknowledge that we are all here today for the Tunaminaway and Mulbohena Commemoration 2025, to remember them and also to honour them as warriors who were hung here till they died for killing two white men. And also today I want to welcome from the Circular Head Aboriginal Corporation, we have Celine Colgrave and we have Camilla and Peter. So welcome to all of you. So for those that don't know, the two boys, Tunaminawaya Marlboyhina, they were from Cape Grim, which is in the Circular Head Shire and comes under the Circular Head Aboriginal Corporation. These young men were warriors and they were unjustly murdered in avenging the death of their countrymen. And these young men who hung here till they died in the prime of their lives, not even to be taken back to their country where they belong. It was the white men who caused this grievous and heinous crime, and they died as a result of the colonisation and bastardry of this country. And today we remember them, but today I want all of you to think about all the white people who have never, ever been charged with murder, poisoning, mass genocide and rape that happened all over this great nation of ours, and all of it government sanctioned. I'm a direct descendant from our first peoples, the Kaurna Trelawaway born, descended from the great Tasmanian warrior, Chief Manalagena and his daughter, Walton Waltiyena, and also Irish and English, and blood cousin to Ngarrwuit Professor Carolyn Briggs, who I mentioned before, who's the elder of the Bunurong. So today I represent Ngarrwuit and always pay my deepest respect to her and to her people. The Bunurong are the custodians of their lands that extend from the Wilson Promontory in the east to the mouth of the Werribee River in the west, encompassing both of our beautiful bays, Western Port we call Mudden and Port Phillip we call Nam. This country is unceded land. Today we meet on the country of our ancestors and we pay our respect, not just today, but always to our ancestors, those people who came before us. And we're all especially pleased to recognise the commitment that you've all made here today in paying respect to the spirit of this land and to our first peoples. Through this, you have shown the willingness to honour sacred ground. We are the oldest surviving living culture in the world. And this is something we want all Australians and peoples of other countries to connect to. Australia also has the world's oldest oral stories. Our first peoples engraved the world's first maps, made the earliest paintings of ceremony, and the very first footprints on this continent were those belonging to our first peoples. First Nations people across Australia all share a special connection to the lands and waters of their ancestors that has not been disconnected from the millennia, despite dispossession, displacement, discrimination, racism, poisoning and massacres that we have experienced over the last 200 years. So we ask that you celebrate and recognise that our First Nations people have occupied and cared for this continent for well over 65,000 plus years. And we invite all Australians and all peoples of other countries that are here with us today to embrace the ancient history of this country, a history that dates back thousands of generations. So I know today we're here for Tunaminawaya Marlboyhina, but when I get the chance to speak, I want to tell other stories too. Some of you may have heard before and some not. So I don't usually talk about my history, but it would be remiss of me to neglect my own ancestor, Manalagena, the last chief of the great tribes of Tasmania. He died on Flinders Island in 1835 after being forced to leave his country along with other nations of people, only approximately 200 of them, under the threat of death. If they didn't go, the government sanctioned that they would all be killed. The governor made a verbal treaty with Manalagena to vacate Tasmania, but that was not to be for Manalagena and most of his people. Manalagena was a very proud warrior that led the Black Wars in Tasmania. And the Black War was a period of violent conflict between the British colonists and Aboriginal Tasmanians from Tasmania from the mid-1820s to 1832. Manlikana was greatly admired, even by the white establishment, for the tactical fights he led. So Manlikana in 1835 died a broken man, pining for his country. They used to sit on the shore and gaze across the water to where their country was. And his second wife, Tanlia Bonner, died 6 months later. But his daughter, Walter Motiana, survived, and her husband, George Briggs, ended up selling her for a guinea to another man. Don't be shocked. It was an extremely harsh world that our people lived in as sealers in the Bass Straits. And the sealers, they traded women and dogs alike. And for that time period, that was the way things worked in the Straits. It was quite a lawless society, like nothing we could ever try and imagine. There are many stories, though. Somehow a group of these Tasmanians made it to Mauritius by sea and were stranded there for a few years before the government sent a ship to bring them back. When Walter Motiana returned, she could speak French, and Walter Motiana was returned to Flinders Island until her daughter, Dolly Dalrymple Briggs, wrote a petition to the governor begging that her mother be allowed to return to Tasmania and live out her days with her family. Dolly was a very famous woman in her own right and was reported to be the first half-caste born in Tasmania, my three times great-grandmother. By 1837, only 47 of our people remained on Flinders Island, and they were transferred to Oyster Cove, south of Hobart, to live out their lives in abject poverty. I've seen photos of these amazing people, and they do not look happy. It's quite an incredibly sad, sad tale. So I can tell you these stories because they're not just a part of my history, but also to my cousins, aunties, uncles, and their ancestors too. We have a right to be able to talk about our people and our history, and we have every right to also be proud of all these people from whom we are descended. Their blood, their spirit, and their tenacity is also a part of us who are still here today. A much, much younger cousin in her 20s, just over a year ago, was on Flinders Island at the graveyard where all these people taken from Tasmania were buried, about 107 of them. And she messaged me to say, I knew our history was sad, but wow, I felt so enraged with anger, heartbreak, and frustration. And there was a very intense feeling. It felt so incredibly heavy there. As much as my heart felt broken, it felt like my world was spinning. A very, very odd feeling. And this from a young woman 189 years later. I sent back saying to her, yes, it will feel of death and despair. And like this place too, death and despair for these young boys. But a death and despair of a people who removed from their homeland under the threat of death only to die in that place. But do not fear, for they are no longer there. But you are left with the death and despair of that place, and it still sits in the air. And this means that you are in touch with your ancestors and have walked where they walked and where they have been. But their spirit does not live in that place. Their spirit is carried with you, and that is what you are feeling, the raw emotion of that place. So these things that we carry within us still today, some people call it intergenerational trauma, which partly it is, but for me, it is that our ancestors live on in us, and that's why our people are a spiritual people, and we can actually feel them. Thank you, everyone.
You're listening to 3CR, and that was Auntie Janet Galpin, who spoke at last year's commemoration for Tanaminawe and Mulpoi Hina. Just a reminder that that is taking place again today at midday, and you can tune in live by listening to 3CR. But if you are able to get down there, the memorial is on the corner of Victoria and Franklin Streets in Melbourne. Before we go to our next interview, we're just going to play a couple of announcements. We'll be back with Rosemary Story in just a moment.
Lest we forget, join us to commemorate the 184th anniversary of the execution of the two Indigenous freedom fighters, Tunaminaway and Morbohina, the first men hung in Victoria for resisting white colonisation.
This is a story of colonisation. It's a story that's been told before.
It's the Tuesday, the 25th of January at midday at the Tunaminaway and Morbohina Monument at the corner of Victoria and Franklin Street in Melbourne. The ceremony will be broadcast live on Community Radio 3CR. At 1 p.m. after the broadcast, we'll be walking down the Queen Victoria Market to what we believe is their burial site, where the ceremony will continue for another hour. Please bring flowers to the event.
Get ready for an exciting summer on 3CR's Community Radio. While many of our regular shows take a well-deserved break, we're still here to keep you connected with fantastic radical radio all summer long. Join us for a lineup of unique one-off specials and highlights from the year that you won't want to miss. Curious about what we have in store? Dive into our summer grid at 3cr.org.au/summer specials.
You're listening to 3CR Tuesday Breakfast, and we are now joined on the line by Rosemary Story from Kinglake Friends of the Forest. Rosemary is a lifelong environmentalist with a particular interest in forests and climate. She is a passionate defender of the forests of the Central Highlands. And Rosemary joins us this morning to talk about the Victorian government's target for containing bushfires at first attack, set at 80%, and the impact that this has on funding, research, personnel when it comes to fighting bushfires. Welcome to 3CR Breakfast, Rosemary.
Thanks so much, Paul. Great to be here.
So you're here this morning to talk about things that have been revealed through the report that was compiled by the Department of Energy, Environment and Climate Action. It was their annual report for 2024-2025, specifically looking at the target that was set by the government in terms of percentage of bushfires contained at first attack and or under 5 hectares to suppress bushfires promptly, that target being set at 80%. So I was wondering if you could tell our listeners more about this.
Yeah, sure. If I could just start by saying that, you know, we're a forest conservation group, that is active, but also, we all also live in the bush, so we all live with the constant risk of bushfires. So, you know, we also want communities to be safe, want our houses not to burn down. So we want the government to be best bushfire planning on best science and doing its best for us, so it's personal.
Yeah, sorry, Rosemary, before you continue, you're just cutting out a little bit, so I'm not sure if you're able just to move where you are, just so we can hear you a bit more clearly.
Is this any better?
Yeah, it's a bit better. How about you continue on and I'll let you know. Yeah.
Okay, all right. So we were pretty shocked to have a look at this year's Speaker's annual report, which has, it's got a graph shows, there's a line that their target for promptly suppressing bushfires is 80%. Against that graphic, what proportion of bushfires are actually suppressing beyond the initial outbreak? And every year for the past 5 years, it's been above 90%. So that kind of begs the question, if they're already doing what they're doing, suppressing more than 90% bushfires. Why do they think 80% is enough? And particularly given that, you know, only 10, 12 of the 200 fires across Victoria this month got seriously out of control. So they did meet the target, and yet we lost 410,000 hectares and 259 homes. But this is within their target. This is okay, according to the government publication. So, yeah, questionable.
Yeah, that is really interesting. Like you said, in the past 5 years, the actual reach has been at in the 90s consistently for the past 5 years. So, yeah, it does raise questions about why the target is 80%. And when we look at this, it makes us look at the consequences that this target might have on things like funding, research, personnel, equipment. So I was wondering if you could talk to us about that aspect. What impact does this have on firefighters, fire organisations' ability to actually fight these fires and keep us safe?
Yeah, exactly. So if the low target, it's reflected in the funding that's provided for equipment, research and personnel. Firefighting agencies are up in arms about their ancient failing trucks and their equipment. There's been really exciting research that looks really promising into the use of drones and other technologies in rapid detection and suppressing bushfires. But, you know, that hasn't been carried forward because apparently the government's doing well enough with fire. Don't really need to improve. So, you know, this research isn't going anywhere. In addition, both CFA, Fire Rescue Victoria firefighters have alleged that proceeds from the state government to emergency services pact isn't even going to the front line. So the consequence is that, you know, if the government thinks they're doing okay with fires already, it looks like they're just really trying to improve. And we would like them to.
Mm. Yeah, and it also raises questions about the current response to fires in terms of the use of things like planned burns to reduce fuel load reduction. I was wondering if you could talk about these practices. I know that Kinglake Friends of the Forest, as well as other grassroots groups, have been speaking a lot about and have published, you know, analyses regarding planned burns and what that actually does for forests and by extension, you know, what that does for bushfires. So, yeah, I was wondering if you could talk about that as what is currently, you know, a go-to response.
Yeah, for sure. And also, can I just jump in and say that the frontline firefighters, definitely not criticising them. They did an incredible job, as they always do. And, you know, their bravery and skill are just incredible. So, yeah, we're talking about government policy here, obviously. So, as you say, there's a huge reliance on the destructive and largely discredited strategy of planned burns in forests. These are also fuel reduction burns, same thing. And also they're doing a lot of clearing of so-called strategic fuel breaks to facilitate backburns. So when I say huge, last year's target for planned burns was over 300,000 hectares of forest in Victoria and $160 million. And the target for strategic fuel breaks, which go through state forests, national parks, you know, whatever's there, is the target out to 2030 is 6,000 kilometres. So, you know, this is big. I think if I could just describe the difference between planned burns and backburning, because they're often used as if they're interchangeable. Mm-hmm. So planned burns are based on the assumption that the longer forest remains unburned, the more flammable it becomes. And, you know, this kind of begs the question of how Australian forests survived for many years before humans arrived. It also ignores scientific evidence that's been stacking up for years now, showing that if you burn forests, you may reduce the likelihood or severity of fire for a very few years, but this only applies under mild weather conditions. In severe conditions, there's no advantage at all in having done a plan burn even very recently. And what's even worse is that after a few years, you get a pulse of regrowth which is far more flammable than before the plan burn happened. And yet, they target long burnt forests, sometimes they have no history of fire at all, making them more fire prone in the future. And, you know, from a personal angle, if you visit one of these sites just after they've done burn, the destruction can be quite a big thing. And, you know, you have to see the impact on that. So that's plan burn, and that would appear to be the main strategy that's used by the government. Backburn, though, basically a pretty desperate measure where you light another fire in the path of an approaching bushfire and try to create a fuel break. And these are dangerous, and they're often counterproductive because, in reality, they often do not have an increase of fire footprint. Sometimes, catastrophically, you might remember the Grampians last year. That was a huge case. And yet, despite this, they're clearing thousands of kilometres of strategic fuel breaks specifically to facilitate extraction. Well, at least that's the publicly stated reason. It's interesting that this is where most of the former loggers are now employed. And because this comes under the heading fire prevention, they have even less regulatory oversight than the logging did. So this is where the resources are going, largely. Meanwhile, we're seeing, you know, a lack of personnel on the ground to keep fires small on a catastrophic day. You know, they know when it's going to be fire danger. They could have a lot more personnel and equipment out there. But again, you know, the low suppression target, it's maybe not surprising. And also, since the Saturday following the recent fires, rather than doing everything to make the most of the cooler climate conditions and put fires out to rest, the government strategy has been to intensify the clearing of forests, again, to facilitate the backburn. So the cost of that decision is that communities are threatened by bigger fires, and the bush gets a triple whammy of bushfires, fires lit by government agencies, and clearing by loggers.
Yeah, what you've said just now, Rosemary, just raises a lot of questions and things to consider. Like you said, you know, in terms of the lack of regulation, and I know that on the show we've spoken to members of Kinglake Friends of the Forest before about Forest Fire Management Victoria, as well as, like you said, government policy, and, you know, not to mention the climate crisis and how that is changing things, changing conditions, and the way in which, the approach to tackling bushfires needs to be considered. Before you go, Rosemary, you sort of alluded to this before, but I was wondering if you could talk about, you know, what is needed moving forward. You know, again, like, to reiterate what you said before, we're not talking about firefighters themselves, we're talking about government policy. So what would you like to see in terms of changes from the government looking forward?
Yeah, well, obviously there are things we need to stop doing. So putting resources into plan burns and these so-called strategic fuel breaks. There's several plan burns in the forest near Creon over recent decades. And that, you know, there have been many. They didn't prevent recent fires. And obviously, planned burning isn't going to prevent fires like long ones, which, although it was referred to as a bushfire. It was all on agricultural land, so it was really more of a grass fire. So once we stopped climbing forests for fire, we need to update resources for our firefighters. You know, they deserve it. For example, fire trucks are being driven around without air conditioning and airbags. And, you know, some of them are actually breaking down because they're, you know, 40 years old. We need more people employed as full-time firefighters. We've got this incredible culture of community members selflessly giving up their time and safety as PFA volunteers. But with, you know, summers are getting longer and more dangerous, and we need more firefighters. And also remote firefighters. These are elite, highly trained specialists, but they're often not sent out because, obviously, they're elite, it's expensive. What they are able to do is be dropped into remote areas and put out fires when they first start. And because we're, or the government is choosing not to do that often, the remote fire can just keep smouldering quietly away. And then bad weather, and suddenly it takes off and it's a threat to communities, not to mention destroying huge areas of forest. And, you know, finally, we need to get with the 21st century and start investing in new technology. The ANU Bushfire Centre of Excellence has developed drones. They're programmed to detect fresh fire outbreaks, drop retardants, and alert crews to the fire's exact location. But this technology has stalled because no one's investing in it. And again, you know, not surprising if keeping all bushfires small is apparently not a government, you know, priority.
Thank you so much for that, Rosemary. As you know, we're in the height of summer and bushfires are becoming more and more regular, even outside of summer itself. So I'm sure this is a conversation that we'll keep having. Thank you so much, though, for coming on the show this morning and explaining to us the report and, I guess, the consequences that this has on firefighters who are trying to suppress and stop these fires, as well as what is needed in the future. I really appreciate your time this morning.
Yeah, well, I really appreciated the opportunity to talk about it. So thanks a lot.
We've been speaking to Rosemary Story from Kinglake Friends of the Forest. Please, if you would like to keep up to date with what's happening in the native forests in the state of Victoria, you can follow Kinglake Friends of the Forest. They have social media, but you can also go to their website, kinglakefriendsoftheforest.com, for reports, events, and other really important information about how to protect our native forests. We're going to go straight into our last segment for this morning. When Miao Xin spoke to Hung from 3CR's Women on the Line about her upcoming art show, I Am a Feminist Lesbian Woman of Colour, which is opening on Wednesday, the 21st of January. Wen Miao Xin is a photographer and visual artist based in Nam. Drawing from her experiences as a lesbian, feminist, and woman of colour, she explores themes of gender, identity, and sexuality through her distinctive visual language. Her work challenges societal norms and celebrates diversity, offering thought-provoking perspectives through the lens of her camera. Here is Hung introducing Wen Miao.
Hi, I'm Hung Pham from Women on the Line at 3CR. This is my interview with Chinese photographer Wen Miao Xin, who has her solo show, I Am a Lesbian, a Feminist, a Woman of Colour exhibition at Trocadero Projects in Footscray. You can check out the exhibition from tomorrow, Wednesday 21st of January, through to the 22nd of February as part of Midsummer. Let's now hear the interview.
Hi, I'm Wen Miao Xin, you can also call me Miao. I'm originally from China and I'm currently living and working in Melbourne, Australia. I'm a photographer and a visual artist. I work across art, fashion, music, theatre and portrait photography. And I use photography as a way to express myself and explore identity, emotion and connections.
So you have a solo exhibition coming up at Trocadero Projects in Footscray titled I Am a Lesbian, a Feminist, and a Woman of Colour. Can you tell us about the exhibition and what it's taken for you to get to your first solo show?
Yes, so the exhibition is called I'm a Lesbian, a Feminist, and a Woman of Color. So the title of pretty much explains the show, and it's also about how I say and define myself. So I would divide the exhibition into three main parts. So one focuses on lesbian and queer intimate relationship, and another looks at feminism, and this third explores experience as an Asian woman living in West. So for this exhibition, I photograph a lot of intimate moments in different bedrooms. I also included some feminist ideas in a very visual way. For example, in one work, I wrote the Chinese character for female directly onto two models' face. And I also photographed women's bodies. And I will be showing some Polaroid photos as well. So most of the Polaroid photos are very personal. They are from my own intimate relationship, photos of my partner. And this project was strongly inspired by Sarah Arman's book, Living a Feminist Life. So when I was doing my master's degree at the University of Sydney, I was studying queer media studies and came across a line where she says, I'm not a lesbian one moment and a person of color the next, and a feminist and another. I'm all of this and every moment. So that line really resonated with me and how I understand my own identity.
So you take photos, you said, in the bedroom space, but also outside of that space. Why is it important to kind of document different aspects of your life for this exhibition?
Yes, so one part of the exhibition was photographed in the real bedroom of real couples. So I choose to photograph them in their own bedroom because I see the bedroom as a space where safety, trust, and vulnerability naturally exist within intimate relationships. So I want my models to feel comfortable enough to show me who they really are in that space. And for me, the bedroom is usually a very private place. So but once I photograph it and the images are printed and showing a gallery, it becomes public to a certain extent. So I'm really interested in that contrast. And I didn't stage the bedroom on purpose. Even the props came from their own homes, like things like the butterfly light or bedsheet over their heads. So I wanted to use objects that already belongs to them because those things carry the histories of their relationship and also reflect a connection that existed before I arrived with my camera. Yeah, so, and also before I take photos, I usually spend time talking with the couples. I ask a lot of questions to understand their relationship, like how they met, how they connect with each other, and what their dynamic is like. I also ask if there's a particular object or detail that feels meaningful to them as a couple. And when I take photos, I'm always looking for a sense of connection. I'm interested in why they choose each other, how that connection is formed, and how fragile it can be at the same time.
Yeah, that sounds really intimate and very considerate. How did you find these couples? Like, were they friends or were some strangers?
Actually, most of the couples are my friends. Like, I found them on Instagram. Like, we follow each other for a long time because, I don't know, in Melbourne, I feel there are some like lesbian communities, like especially living in Brunswick or living different suburbs. Yeah, so most of my couples I found on Instagram. Yeah.
Nice. So masks are a recurring element in your photography, whether it be through veils over a couple's head, sleeping masks. You also paint on the face as well, which I do see as a form of like armor in some way to physically paint on someone's face. Can you share with our listeners what this represents to you?
I actually didn't realize at first how often masks appear in my work. So when I cover couples' head with the bed sheets, what I was thinking about is creating a private space to them. So I want this element to show their emotions and the connections between them. So I'm also drawn to masks because my own coming out journey as a lesbian was long and painful. So growing up in my hometown, being gay was often seen as abnormal and also as weirdo. So hiding parts of myself became a way to survive. I think this is also why identity is such an important theme in my work. And in the other work, like the photos where I paint a model's face, I just wrote two Chinese characters, meaning female, on their face to express my feminist identity and a perspective.
You also photograph for Vogue, working in the fashion space. How has this experience shaped your perspective as a photographer?
Yes, so working in a fashion space has definitely shaped how I see photography and storytelling. So fashion photography has taught me a lot about lighting, composition, styling, and creating a mood quickly. But I think no matter whether I'm shooting my own projects or fashion portraits, the most important thing is the people. So I need to focus on people. I have to care about my models and pay attention to the individual. And I need to communicate with them and also understand them. At the same time, working fashion has made me reflect on my own voice as an artist. So it's helped me to see the difference between creating images for clients or a brand and also creating images that are deeply personal, like exploring identity, intimacy and connection, which is exactly what I try to do in my own projects.
Beautiful. And so what are you interested in exploring next through photography?
Next, I want to keep exploring my personal identity and experience. I'm especially interested in photographing lesbian queer women who have lived experience similar to mine, like people who feel like they exist between Eastern and Western cultures. I'm also planning to make a video project in both my hometown and Melbourne, which I'm really looking forward to. Yeah.
In terms of the exhibition, where can we find out more about it?
So my show will be in the Gallery 1 of Chalk and Darrow Project in Footscray. Yeah, and the opening night will be 21st of January, Wednesday, 6 to 8 p.m. So the show will take 4 months, from 21st of January to 22nd of February, 2026.
Thank you to Women on the Line's Hung for bringing us this interview with Wen Miaoxin, who is a local photographer and visual artist whose show I Am a Feminist, Lesbian, Woman of Colour opens tomorrow, Wednesday, the 21st of January. Before we give a wrap-up of what we had on today's program, we just wanted to let listeners know about some events coming up in the next few days. So at 12 p.m. today, 3CR will broadcast live from the Tanaminawe and Molboihina Memorial on the corner of Victoria Street and Franklin Street, Melbourne. This is the site where these two Aboriginal freedom fighters were executed 184 years ago. If you are able to go down to the event, please do. Otherwise, you can tune into 3CR and you'll hear from community members who will honour the memory of Tanaminawe and Molboihina and share stories and songs of resistance to the colonisation of this continent, past and present. Tomorrow, Wednesday, the 21st of January at 8 a.m., held at Station Pier in Port Melbourne, there will be a demonstration with the Maritime Union for fair agreement for workers on Carnival cruise ships. This mostly migrant workforce have been forced to settle for precarious contracts, often with wages of as little as $2.50 an hour. And Carnival will be sailing into Nam tomorrow for the Australian Open. So if you can head down to Port Melbourne to stand in solidarity with these workers, again, that is tomorrow at 8 a.m. Station Pier in Port Melbourne. For more information, you can go to Maritime Union Vic branch. And at 3:30 p.m. on Thursday, 22nd of January, there's a snap action outside Aston MP Mary Doyle's office to demand Labour disinvite war criminal President Herzog and sanction Israel. So on today's program, we heard from Kath Strong, who spoke to Marion on Tuesday Home Time about boycotting Eurovision 2026. We spoke to Lucinda Thorpe from Digital Rights Watch about GROK, how it's being used to create images to degrade, humiliate women and children. We heard from Auntie Janet Galpin, who spoke at last year's Tanaminawe and Molbohina commemoration. We spoke to Rosemary Story from Kinglake Friends of the Forest about the neglect of the Victorian government in setting more ambitious targets to help fund and provide firefighters with better equipment. And then we just heard from Wen Miao Xin, who spoke to Hung about her upcoming art show. Stay tuned. Up next will be Accent of Women. Thank you for joining us on Tuesday Breakfast this morning. We will be back next week at 7 a.m.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall Carlton. You can buy books online and keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.